Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to do a bit of a market update. Haven't done one of those for a while, but things have been weird. So it is worth covering what's going on. Now, everything that I sort of spelt out in the previous Brokenomics, I still stand by that. I still think that the liquidity is ultimately the driver of everything, and I still think that's coming because, well, look, there's $8 trillion of debt that needs to get rolled over, and you know, how else are they going to do it? I mean, are they going to suddenly discover prudent government spending and, you know, austerity and debt reduction going into the US midterms? I would consider that somewhat unlikely. But nevertheless, the market patterns have been just outright weird and is worth covering. So, I mean, markets are just behaving in a way that just does confuse everybody. You know, crypto hasn't rallied in the same way that other assets have. Bitcoin is below the, well, whatever it was, $121,000 late to 2025 high. And it's bouncing around instead of setting new records. But at the same time, precious metals like silver and gold have been extremely volatile with, you know, these sharp surges upwards followed by these quite deep pullbacks. Actually, I'm glad I timed that right on the silver Brokenomics I did recently. You know, I think it was at 121 on the day that I recorded that. And I said, look, I do believe in the underlying message, but there is going to be a hell of a lot of volatility here and expect a pullback. And about 3 days after I filmed that, it did. And I think it pulled back down to, whatever the sort of the interim low that it hit, like in the high 70s. So, you know, stuff is odd because certain assets are responding to this picture very differently to how other assets are. And you might well want to know what's going on, as would I, to be honest. It's kind of not the case anymore that we don't get to do the sort of Warren Buffett thing anymore. Warren Buffett made an enormous amount of money by buying good companies and then waiting and then selling them when they got high, which is a strategy that can work now. And I think that's basically what I'm doing these days. But the interim volatility is significantly high. You don't look at your portfolio and think, oh, I made 2-3% this year. All I need to do is just wait 50 years and I'll be, you know, a decamillionaire. Now you can get much faster returns, but the cost of that is very significant volatility. And volatility to the point where you feel like you've made a stupid mistake and you've got it all wrong and you're blowing your life savings and panic, you need to sell, run away. And actually, that might not even be wrong, because the reason you might be saving, I mean, your time horizon, your risk profile is different from mine. And that's why I'm always kind of shying away from giving anything too specific rather than a way to think about this. But actually, you might be saving for a house deposit or something in your life that means you actually need the money at the time. And so it might well be the case for a lot of you, the profile of the old Warren Buffett years, the, you know, sort of 60s and 70s and 80s, of just buying good stuff and watch it tick up, you know, not by a huge amount, but by a predictable amount, and it compounds over time, would be fantastic for you. And maybe you can still do that with some companies if you're prepared to accept, you know, the low returns, even though those good companies are still going to be buffeted around by the whole liquidity cycle thing going on. But I prefer to play at the faster end of this stuff, but it does mean periods of head-scratching volatility and market disconnects. And, you know, I think it is liquidity. I think it's always going to be liquidity. And, you know, something like Bitcoin, it does sit pretty far out on the risk curve. And so when there is any sort of liquidity retrenchment or it pulls back for a period, it does get hit and quite hard. And also, of course, there was the big structural break in, 1010, October of last year, a big sort of liquidation event in the crypto markets. And that takes time to heal. So I don't think that the issue is that, you know, the cycle is dead, nor do I think it's that liquidity hasn't shown up. I think it's that price patterns are showing a lot of uncertainty as to where to allocate and when. And that's kind of what I want to get into with this one. So, I mean, let's have a look at what the data is actually saying. you will remember that on plenty of previous occasions I've talked about these purchasing manager index, which is a really good way of seeing what's going on in the economy. So apparently firms have these people called purchasing managers, and apparently their job is to buy stuff. And for whatever reason, I reply in the comments, if you are a purchasing manager and you actually understand the world, I just understand that the metric is good. When purchasing managers start buying stuff, it is a very reliable indicator that the economic cycle is turning up, because those firms are expanding and they're doing stuff. Anyway, so these purchasing managers indexes that I like to talk about, there's one that kind of sits over them called the ISM, which is a sort of a combining of various of them. And that is kind of like the key benchmark for where we sort of the business cycle. Now that has risen to 52.6. Now anything over 50 shows business expansion, right? So it is good. It clearly shows that we are in a state of expansion again. Services PMIs are actually even a little bit stronger. You know, 53.8. I remember looking at. That's continued steady growth. What else have we got? Silver, I mean, that's swung around violently. So, yeah, what did it hit? Like I said, it hit something like 120, followed by these sharp declines. Bitcoin, which, as you know, is a bit of a favourite of mine, it's been range-bound. It's substantially lower than it was pre-10-10, pre-October of last year. And it's subject to these sort of constant volatilities and liquidations and so on. So, look, starting to bring this together, you're getting mixed signals. Parts of the economy are moving at different speed. Manufacturing is improving, and the cyclical sectors are beginning to expand. What do I mean by cyclical sectors? Commodities are early. Logistic firms supplying components, they're early in the cycle. As I come to talk to you later, gold is early in the cycle. Things like insurance are quite late in the cycle. So if you can map where different sectors are, you are seeing those bits that are early on the cycle, the cyclicals, starting to do quite well. Service is holding up. Metals pricing is getting extreme. Markets are pricing, you know, uncertainty over growth, really. So look, when liquidity tightens or becomes ambiguous and it is not sending clear message, assets that rely on those capital flows, such as Bitcoin and crypto, they're going to lag, even if the sort of broader macro indicators are actually looking quite interesting. So it's more of a liquidity signal puzzle rather than a broken market regime. The macro data, the PMIs and the ISM, they're showing early expansion, while risk assets, they're still delayed. Precious metals, they often lead as liquidity proxies. In fact, I think if you take the chart of gold and you just shift it back in time by about 6 months, something like that, it pretty much mirrors Bitcoin's chart. It just leads. It's ahead of it. So I think the indicators are there and they're looking good. So I've not seen anything that makes me worry, but some of you may, and therefore it is important to address. I don't even think that the current market conditions are necessarily contradictory. What we're seeing is a sequencing effect. So, you know, macro data can expand and tighten and expand before liquidity actually flows into risk assets. And that lag is what is making everything look really weird at the moment. So debt rollover, let's come back to that because it is so important to all of this. You know, governments, especially in the US and Western, well, actually every Western government, to be honest, they've got a huge amount of debt that must be refinanced this year. They've got older bonds issued to fund government spending at whatever point they're issued. They don't pay them off, and they need to issue new bonds in order to replace the old ones that are rolling off. And the more debt there is, and the higher the interest rate, the more expensive and harder that becomes for governments. And policymakers don't like to see that. They like to be able to fund their programs cheaply. So they often preferred to keep financial conditions easier so that their cost of servicing the government remains manageable. And it's that debt rollover that drives the debasement, the lowering the value of every particular pound or dollar or Aussie dollar or Canadian dollar or whatever. But the US still has $8 trillion of debt that it's got to roll over this year. And basically, the system that they always choose debasement over defaults. I mean, they could, I suppose, say, look, we've borrowed too much money. We can't afford to pay it back. We're not paying it back. Immediate financial crisis, undermining of the entire system. So they're going to debase it. From my point of view, this stuff is so elementary and simple. Then no one in office is going to be the guy who blows up the system when they can just debase the money supply instead. And that's what they always do. And I just don't see any indication that this time is going to be different. So in other words, the refinancing forces a bias towards looser money, cheaper money, and policies that help the market rather than tighten them. They just can't do it all the time because then inflation would get out of control. But it looks like that inflation is pretty much under control. And midterms are coming up, so just seems so elementary to me what's going to happen next, even if it is choppy on the way there. And thus, I am not concerned at all. I mean, stop the video there if that's satisfying for you, but I just don't see the issue. Well, I do see an issue that getting there is by no means smooth, and it's testing, and it makes you think that you've done something terribly wrong, but I'm not sure that is. But look, the mechanism is government issues a debt. The banks hold and absorb that debt if markets aren't strong enough, which is what's happening. And when banks expand their balance sheet because regulators allow them to through various mechanisms, money supply is going to grow, credit grows, more liquidity. And that keeps the long-term yields that governments have to pay suppressed, even if nominal interest rates remain higher than you'd think they'd ideally want, although they'll probably get that down as well. So the net result is similar to easy money, but it doesn't necessarily require the headline interest rate to get cut. And it doesn't even necessarily require quantitative easing, you know, such as we saw in abundance during the COVID era. They can get there through a number of other means. So the debt rollover is constant. It's structural at this point. It's unavoidable. Even if the macro conditions are mixed, the financing pressure itself creates a built-in bias towards these looser conditions. And it's why some risk assets are starting to lift off without there being an obvious stimulus announcement or big headline thing that you can point to say, yes, that, because of that, and then markets take off. I think they're sniffing out what's going on. So liquidity, we should address that after debt. Markets were expecting in the build-up of last year to see more liquidity to support headlines into 2026. But instead, what we actually saw was a temporary liquidity gap. And that happened because various cash flows were pulled out of the system or blocked, not because the demand changed from the government side. And it shows up in risk assets, especially in volatile ones, Bitcoin being the classic example. And so we've had these sort of, you know, air pockets that have developed. You know, there was various US government shutdowns, which surprisingly compared to other government shutdowns that I remember in my life, we're not talked about that much, but it does have a huge effect on liquidity. And so markets weren't necessarily signaling cycle over. They were signaling that liquidity was not present when they were expecting it to be present. And it doesn't lead to a full-scale retreat, neither does it lead to things going up. What it leads to is the stuff that responds to this chopping around quite violently in between while they're trying to figure out what's going on. The Treasury General account, I've mentioned that before, that is being built up, and that's reducing the amount of money in circulation, and that's partly a function of all these government shutdowns that we've had. There's the reverse repo facility I've talked about before. That was previously built up and started to get drained out, and that would normally be very good, but it couldn't quite offset the fact that the US government itself was building up its piggy bank. And the prolonged government shutdown in 25, it just disrupted all of these normal flows that should be happening. And so you combine these together, and what you kind of get is this liquidity hole or air pocket where the assets that I like would have been responding to more positively. But nevertheless, PMIs are good. It shows that something interesting is going on or starting to build, and it's taking longer than I thought, but it still seems to be happening. And I don't know how they could possibly fund the system at this point if they didn't encourage it to happen. So we got a pattern, which is strong underlying macro signals, but weak price action. And essentially, it's a sequencing issue. It's real economy indicators are recovering before the liquidity, as you'd expect, actually. And it results in these volatile, weird markets that we're seeing. So the crucial issue here is really time lag. Macro is improving, but not immediately turning into demand return. And these financial markets, they need confidence. They want to see balance sheets repair. They want to see capital available before they can rally sustainably. And in this case, all the data that I'm seeing suggests that economic conditions have improved, but liquidity has not yet been restored in asset markets and given these weird conditions. Also, I should go into that 10-10, you know, October of last year, that weird crypto breakdown. And crypto basically had a bit of a market plumbing issue. You know, it had this sudden cascade of forced sellers. Too many people were using leverage. Too many people just got too excited, got over their skis, leveraged up, and basically the market was so weighted in one direction that it was vulnerable, and it could be people betting the other way suddenly found that they had a nice big gap underneath to make money in. And so, and however, whatever the mechanism for triggering it was, whatever market manipulation or hedge fund or whatever prompted it, I don't think we fully understand yet. Prices fell, people with over leveraged positions started to get wiped out, and then it sort of tumbled in on itself. You effectively had a bit of a flash crash. And the reason I'm using the term flash crash is because I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago, sort of pre-COVID period, there was a what we call now a flash crash in the markets. And this happened to equities. And it was basically the same thing. Equity investors had got overexcited, leveraged up, you know, gone on the bubble like 10 times, 11 times, 12 times, something stupid like that, stupidly over leveraged. And the same mechanism, they just got wiped out in this liquidity event. Now, at that time, people didn't say, oh, equities are over forever, you know, forget equities, you know, company stocks and shares are never going to be a thing again. You know, it's just one of those readjustments that you can't let people get, well, if people get too excited, you make it too easy to take their legs out from them because they're not on sure footing. So the crypto version of a flash crash kind of needed to happen because it needed to clear out all that hype and leverage so that basically the market had a firmer footing to proceed on. And these breaks, they take time to heal. And when there is a big break like that, nobody's bidding. And, you know, it was definitely a crypto event, but it's not actually fundamentally dissimilar to previous equity flash crashes. I think the concrete data points that we can look at in this is that of the October 10 liquidity event, around 19 billion was wiped out in about 24 hours. And it's the largest liquidation in crypto to date. Still negligible when you compare it to past flash crashes in equities, though. And it's the kind of number that leaves very plausibly a multi-month hangover that needs to be worked through, and balance sheets need to be repaired and confidence needs to return and stuff. So the cleanest way to reconcile that, okay, macro should be improving and the indicators say that it is, with Bitcoin feels suppressed, is that, you know, the broader macro picture, the economic picture is turning, but Bitcoin's internal risk engine, which is leverage and, you know, exchange structure, can delay the response. In other words, the cycle is remaining intact, but the transmission mechanism expressed in crypto prices is temporarily damaged and needs to settle down. Now, financial conditions, I think, are easing, even if it doesn't necessarily feel it from the headline numbers. And when money gets easier, borrowing cost falls, the dollar will weaken, and investors will expect rate cuts, and certain assets move first. Gold is a prime example of this. Gold rises when the dollar falls and yields fall. And that can happen before that translates into crypto. Although I think crypto is expressing the same mechanism, only more so when it comes to that point. So you can get a situation where the metals are screaming, but Bitcoin looks stuck. And that doesn't necessarily mean that Bitcoin is broken. It just means that Bitcoin is late to the party because that's how it behaves. You know, financial conditions lead liquidity, and gold often smells it first and moves first. Effectively, I'm saying gold is mirroring these financial conditions, but the time offsets are different. Gold smells it, financial conditions improve, Bitcoin responds. There is sort of this sort of lag process. You know, US 10-year now, so the cost for the US government of borrowing money, it's down a bit now. It's 4.14%, which is high. It's at the low end of normal pre-2008. Post-2008, it is abnormally high. Gold, I checked that this morning. I think that's a bit over 5,000 at the time of recording. Silver, I'm seeing improvement there. I think I saw it at 86 this morning. And Bitcoin is sort of floating around. I think this morning I saw $67,000. And on the other side of things, I saw a Reuters article this morning saying that the dollar had hit a four-year low recently. I mean, that wasn't today's article. That was from about a week back. But you are setting expectations of what the whole macro picture looks like at this point. So, falling yields, plus weak dollar, looser financial conditions, all of that leads to higher global liquidity, as we've talked about many times. Risk assets catch up to that, and precious metals front run it. So look, gold and yields are telling you that the price of money is easing, and Bitcoin is telling you that its own structure is still healing. And that's why I don't feel that this mismatch is some sort of great contradiction that needs to be resolved. It's just that sequencing signal. And when that flips, and I believe it will, the move could be quite violent upwards. And we're just in this sort of positioning period of a lot of months of chop in between of that. So the regime shift towards easier money. A lot of the way that money gets easier is not obvious. It's not a big press conference at the central bank or in the White House. You know, from now on, money's going to be easier. Sometimes it can be done through quite really boring mechanisms, technical rule changes that allow the system to accommodate more debt and make money more flow more easily. And it always sounds a bit, either dull or arcane. And the people doing it, they like to use a lot of acronyms. But essentially what they're doing is they're getting more money into the system that they need there. And they're doing it in a way that can kind of go under the radar, apart from anyone who's familiar with the system. They understand exactly what's going on, and they start to position accordingly. And you know, it might not be with screamingly obvious quantitative easing like they did over COVID, but I mean, you're starting to see it with what's the new one? It's always these bloody acronyms. Bank rule changes. The latest one, I believe, is the ESLR. I could break down the acronym for you, but quite frankly, I would have to check exactly what the hell does that stand for. The end result is they're making it easier for banks to take more risk and have more money. So rather than dig into all the current list of acronyms, which will bloody change next time anyway, so there's no point learning these sodding things. The point is they're making it easier for banks to throw more money around and increase liquidity. So I'll just keep it at that level for now. Go and read some Financial Times if you really want to dig into the the particulars of how they're doing it. Simple message: they're just pumping more money in. Modern financial systems are broad in ways that the system can ease. So, you know, the central bank balance sheet moves, that's a nice obvious one. Traditional quantitative easing and asset purchases and rate cuts and stuff like that. And we may start to see some of that closer to the midterms, but for now, we don't really need it. But the other mechanism is just balance sheet expansion. So banks, not the central bank, but other banks buying government bonds with various rule changes that encourage them to do so, bank lending increasing, and banks leveraging up when the regulations permit. And that's what the ESLR is all about, effectively. If you enjoyed that content, and of course you did because you are a smart person, then why don't you go over to lotuseaters.com where you can watch the whole episode for as little as £5 a month, which really is not much money at all, and you get loads of really good content.